Hey, hey, welcome to the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. I'd like to first of all thank my sponsor, White Oak Pastures. Their cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, fertile coastal soil. Cattle allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all their lives. White Oak Pastures, all-natural grass-fed beef, has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. We hope that you support their program through a purchase at these Whole Foods. For more info, go to www.whiteoakpastures.com. I'd like to thank my guests today. And we are not in Philadelphia, but we do have a show about brotherly love and collaboration in Adam and Brad Farmery. Brad Farmery is the chef, executive chef, owner, I don't know what the, you know, titular nature of these things are anymore, of Public Restaurant and Double Crown in New York. Adam is one of the founding principals of the design and construction architecture firm Avroco. Yeah.
A lot of kung fu.
Yeah, and a little bit of kung fu. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Right. I don't even remember when I actually met Brad for the first time. I think it was during a Chow.com shoot about amuse-bouche, and he won me over with his the eel with the pickled bean sprouts and the quail egg, and yeah. I already knew that there was kind of more than a rapport there. It was his passion for sourcing these not exotic ingredients. Well, yes, exotic here, but not necessarily in Oceania, Australia, New Zealand, the purple people of risk. But it also was coupled with this amazing architecture of Public, which had these distinct, idiosyncrasies of travels and of passions of worldly features that weren't native to New York. And that was seen through Adam's eyes. Public Restaurants located, I believe, 22 Elizabeth Street.
210
Elizabeth Street. I got one of the numbers, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, I'm not your reservation. I'm sending everyone the wrong place. And Adam, Avroco, is on the third floor of that specific address as well.
Yeah.
So the collaboration, you know, not only happened when the restaurant opened, but has ceased to end. Constantly, collaborating new ideas, but also you guys mentioned outside that staff meal happens for both, you know, Avroco and Public Restaurant at Public every day. So that must be a nice time to see and then bounce new ideas off each other.
Yeah, it's definitely an unusual situation where the design firm the design firm itself, Avroco, my partners and I have developed the firm in such a way that tends to specialize in working in hospitality in general. So we're designing a lot of restaurants and hotels and lounges and bars. And so the guys that are working in the studio, the guys and girls that are working in the studio, having such a direct connection to a living, working animal is a real treat and really gives them an unusual ability to kind of understand the animal in a deeper way than what a lot of designers get access to. And sometimes that means that they, you know, if you're trying to measure out exactly what the overhang of a bar over a bar die needs to be, you just go downstairs and measure it. And sometimes if it means that you want to learn how to bake bread, you'll go and work in the kitchen for a day under the pastry chef. Or if it means that you just want to try to forget some of the craziness of your projects, it means that, you know, at the end of the day, you prop yourself at the end of the bar and kind of figure out enjoying and understanding the restaurant in that way.
But it was also a dangerous caveat, I think, to collaborate with each other, because I remember Brad telling me while designing the restaurant, you kind of said, you know, how big do you want the kitchen? And that's something you don't ask any chef. I mean, you cap limitations on, but being in his kitchen, the flow, the manner of not just which food, but people move is efficient and graceful. And was that something you guys talked through, or was it more from a design or chef standpoint?
I think we are very lucky that it was a conversation. And I think that conversation rarely happens with other restaurants, where the chef and the designers can sit down and talk about everything that you just said, the flow, the dynamics, the lighting, things that quite often don't get considered once the front of house stops. Or the chef always wants a little bit more. But, you know, there was a way to do it in an affordable fashion that really wasn't that difficult. And yet it makes work so much easier, and everything about the kitchen works so much better.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking about the difference between, you know, the front of the house and the back of the house, Brad, were you involved in, you know, the ideas that went into design implements in the front of the house, the bar, the, you know, seating?
I think that
he designed everything.
Everything. Give him all the credit.
Yeah. My stamp's all over it. I think, you know, I think my opinion was considered, which is nice. And we wanted the whole restaurant to emanate a feeling. And I think that because the design and the menu and the wine and the service style all came from one group who was creating this feeling, I think it's linear and it has that feeling. It's very, very different from other restaurants, very dynamic. You know, I think that it's cohesive, you know, instead of just here's a cool design and here's a menu and here's a wine list. And I'm sure we can find out how they all go together.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of linear, let's move back chronologically and talk about your upbringing in Pittsburgh. Yeah, as Adam said, you know, obviously the design capital of the world.
Yeah. Huge.
Yeah. I mean, what were your influences in both food and design while growing up?
That's really an interesting question. It was funny. We were talking about this the other day, my partners and I, in the design firm. All of us grew up in the suburbs in different parts of, you know, the country. And Brad and I had this similar experience, I looking at sort of the suburbs of Pittsburgh. And the design of suburban America is not exactly the launching pad for a great kind of mindset.
Really, Levittown worked.
Yeah. And I think fortunately for us, Brad probably had it a little bit easier because our parents were both a little bit more food forward than the typical suburban parents. You know, mom always had a great garden in the back, and dad was capable of bringing home a whole pig and sort of dealing with it in the bathtub in unusual ways, or at least unusual ways to a 5-year-old.
Yeah. We're still talking about food.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
But you know, design was a little bit trickier, you know, in the suburbs. You had to really kind of look for it, and it had to kind of, it started with trying to get out of the suburbs. I mean, just to be very honest and frank. But there was not a whole lot that would have said about myself or any of my partner's experience in the suburb, growing up in the suburbs, that would have said that this is where we would eventually have been.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has parlayed into a lot of world travel and inspiration, public based in New Zealand, Australian foods, mm-hmm. Double Crown based in British Empire foods, and
yeah.
You had spoke, you're doing a couple new projects in Asia as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, definitely, and maybe that's it. Maybe growing up in the suburbs, you just yearn to kind of get the hell out and
yeah.
explore the world, and after, you know, while doing that, you know, you start doing that as a teenager, and your eyes are just wide. You know, you're just sucking it all in, and that starts to really maybe get that creative brain moving in an unusual way.
I think that is a big part of it. You know, I think wanting to get out and get amongst it and get all these different vibes and feelings and put yourself in a different culture,
mm-hmm.
Not just the food, the architecture, but everything, you know, and being able to spend some time out there and then bring that back. And I think that was probably a pretty powerful influence on both of us.
Yeah, I think it's unusual. We were talking once that Brad and I both have a similar, I think both of our processes of how we go about finding a result in our particular fields is very similar, and it's something that starts with finding an inspiration from a certain culture or a certain historical aspect, you know. So in design, you know, it might mean investigating a particular aspect of a culture and then bringing that forth in a new way and representing it in a new way within a project that has a certain contextual sense to that project, but also taps into maybe a collective consciousness that is under the belly
yeah.
of what typically you would look at a certain culture and you would say, oh, well, I know what that thing is, but there's always things that are kind of deeper rooted. And I think that happens probably with food as well, where, you know, he sort of sometimes will take a certain understanding of how certain flavors or certain combinations of things should go together in a traditional way and then flips it by tweaking the ingredients in a certain
way. I mean, how was public, what was the impetus behind that wasn't going to be, you know, Crocodile Dundee / Kitschy?
I think the impetus was foolishness. I'm not sure we really understood how much we didn't know. But I think the impetus was a lot of the work, at least from a food standpoint, a lot of the work that I had done in London. I had known so many Australian chefs, New Zealand chefs, and I'd got to meet so many of the people that create these products, the winemakers and the guys making olive oil down there, and the fishermen and the farmers. And the fact that every time I would come to visit Adam, I'd see one New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc on the wine list, and they thought that they had that section covered.
Yeah.
And so many of these ingredients I'd used on and off for 9 or 10 years just were not being used at all over here. And so I thought that so much of that food seemed true to what I wanted to do. It was lighter. It was really fresh and naturally colorful and flavorful, and instead of being this heavily 20 hands on each plate type of food.
Aside from kangaroo, what were some of the ingredients that you were hoping to bring for?
The New Zealand snapper, the New Zealand John Dory, so much of the Pinot Noir from Central Otago that now is sort of hitting people's lists, Australian Riesling.
The Cervina.
The Cervina. The, Acajura and interesting spices like that, and, Manuka honey. So many of these things had such a sense of place and such an interesting was an interesting flavor component that people really weren't getting into. And I thought that it's a very easy way to kind of open people's eyes to all the other things that are out there.
Yeah, and to kind of set that plate to a palate, Adam, did you travel to these locations where these specific ingredients were from?
Fortunately, Brad and I had have always gotten along pretty well. So even when he was living in London for about 10 years, he was either coming to New York or I was going to London, and then we'd use that as a jumping off point to either go down to New Zealand for, even 5 weeks at a pop and just kind of really experiencing and enjoying it. And also that goes as well with a lot of the flavor elements that he was bringing in, I think, from Northern Africa or even the Middle East, and that was coming out of trips and sort of understanding the basis and of where those things were coming from too.
Yeah, I mean, with the design elements there, Edison light bulbs, a lot of the original features of, what was it, a Connecticut muffin factory?
The old Connecticut muffin company, yeah.
And prior to that, do you even want to say what it was?
Maybe not.
Yeah. But, you use those initial design elements to then be able to draw out, these implements from traveling. Were there any direct relations to, like Manuka honey was directly Edison light bulbs or?
Not as much. I think that a lot of the space design evolved from finding an era of recent American history in which there was an epitomization of travel. There was this epitomization of what it meant to kind of have these goals that you would yearn for, and we were looking towards the kind of 40s, 50s as that sort of launching point for a lot of American travel.
What I have in my head is what the Sierra Club was like, or still is.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a library filled with books about 101 best ways to cook jam, and it's just so sort of base that you look back on it now and you think how ridiculous. But there was a certain ideal that I think people had back in the 40s and 50s that they were sort of searching for, and we really wanted to capture that spirit, because I think out of that spirit is where Brad was launching his food directive from, that he had the spirit of free flowing, that he would be able to combine these things in unique ways.
Yeah.
Another thing I always liked about the design of it and the food sort of intermingling was that I think when people first walk into Publix, some of it might be mild shock as to how these disparate elements can actually come together. But it's sort of once you're in the space that you understand, hardwood, office doors, exposed brick.
The old hardwood office doors exposed brick trick.
Yeah.
that's a common one.
Yeah. But it's it's very comfortable elements, and what seemed like really unusual choices actually come together in a very comfortable environment. And I think it's the same thing with the food. When people first read the menu, they were like, ooh, I don't know if I like that.
I like crispy goat's cheese polenta? I don't know. Maybe I do.
But, once it's in front of them, they're like, wow, actually, this looks pretty good. And when they get it in their mouth, of course, these elements actually are memorable and are harken back to something else that they've tasted before. So it's not reinventing the wheel, it's just readjusting some of the focus.
And it's like harkening back, I think, it's that tapping into that collective consciousness that we as a group of of humans have, and that we do have a connection to certain types of flavor profiles, and we do have a connection to how a combination of certain materials will make us feel and or think, even if it's not necessarily on the surface, it's a deeper psychological connection. I think that happens a lot in that space, and I think it happens a lot with the food. And that's probably the best understanding the marriage of those things.
Good amalgamation. Before we get too heady and too deep, we're going to take a quick break.
It's too late, man. Yeah.
But we are going to come back.
Or the space looks good and the food tastes good. Whatever.
We are going to come back and talk about the kind of ethos versus aesthetics and, you know, how Brad builds a plate, whether or not it's food or fashion first. You listen to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan. Welcome back to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, with guests Adam and Brad Farmery. Do you guys like it when people say Adam and Brad Farmery, or would you like to be your own?
As long as I'm
entity?
First. I think Brad
alphabetical, brother. Yeah. Alphabetical.
Brad and Adam has a great ring to it.
But who was first? I mean, chicken? Who's chicken?
What do you think?
Egg?
What do you think?
I don't know. I'm just going to say twins and call it even.
Irish twins.
Siamese. Well,
we are very Irish twins. Adam was born March 14th, and I was born the next year, March 12th. So I was the twin that just took a little longer.
Yeah.
You know, I was still brewing.
Still maturating. Still is. Yeah. it's interesting because we have an older brother as well who's about a year older than I am. And with three boys growing up in the house, there's always a lot of rambunctiousness. But for some reason, Brad and I tended to ended up going through our lives a little bit closer. And so it was a natural affinity for when we decided to open a restaurant. My partners and I have all known each other for about 20 years. And then add on to that, Brad, who I've known for a little bit longer. I won't say how many. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it seemed to make sense because we had a family already that was going to go about this effort in a way that was not strictly just based on a business plan. I mean, we had a business plan and we're not complete morons. But it was based a little bit more on the fact that there was a certain sensibility that we all shared and that we knew that it was going to, if we just kind of followed through with our efforts, that it would most likely work out.
So, okay. I mean, it kind of went against the saying of never work with family.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny. I tell everybody else, never work with family. But, and there was probably more than a few moments where, you know, there were screaming matches, you know, in the middle of a construction site or in the middle of a kitchen or in the middle of a manager's meeting, in that kind of lineage of, you know, pre-opening and opening and then even after it was open. And there still is to some degree, but you can, you know, that at the end of the day, you can at least kind of hug it out and you don't really mean to, you know, and you don't really mean it when you say you're an asshole. I mean, it was really just...
Oh, you mean it.
Well, I might mean it a little bit.
But yeah, and also that you, at the end of the day, you know, we all have each other's best interest at heart. And I think that's the best thing about working with family is that, you know, you don't have to explain everything. You just know that you really, everyone's passionate about it, and that's why you like working with the person. You might not agree on it, but they're as passionate as you are about the project, and they want it to be really cool and really different and really interesting.
So. And speaking of different, interesting, let's kind of segue into your second venture, Double Crown, and Madame Geneva there with. what was the idea behind trying to open a second monstrous, humongous space? Yeah,
I remember you came by that one day during construction.
Yeah.
And who were you with? It was
I don't
with
even
King,
remember.
I think. Maybe.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, it was that construction was definitely a bit of an animal.
Yeah, and that between our friend King, chef at Kuma M. I mean, that's much bigger space than he has.
Yeah, a little bit,
slightly.
But that was an interesting. You know, public was had been successful, and our investors were very happy with the proceeds of what we were able to do there, and so they really were keen on us developing a new project, and so we had gone about and developed a business plan and got the investment together, but had taken a little bit longer to find the actual space. And while we were...
Well, didn't you find a couple spaces?
We found a couple, and maybe the community board was less than pleased with us on a few of them. And but we eventually kind of settled, but we were fortunate enough to be sort of granted this corner space right on the Bowery, Bowery and Bleecker, and it's just such an amazing location. But in the meantime, we had all started a lot more travel. You know, the design firm had opened up an office in Asia and started to do a lot of projects in Asia, and Brad had continued his global travels and was starting to do a lot more in Asia. So the kind of connection to wanting to do something that was had a slightly Asian bent to it was just came out of the process of our lives. That coupled with we had been reading a lot about early gin manufacturing.
Yeah.
So
and we like to drink it.
Yeah.
So it was a natural kind of evolution about sort of being Westerners in distinctly Eastern places and having that feeling and trying to marry that sensibility that we had internally as both designers as well as chefs. And linking that back to the kind of British exploration of the same areas that we were traveling in. And so we were kind of re-going down those roads, but in a much more modern sense.
Yeah, so you just put a flag in it, right?
Put a flag in it.
We'll take it.
But I mean, some of the amazing design elements, such as the chains hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
All the lamps that you have the fixtures up there. Where did you find those? Were those something you were seeking or... sought you and just made it.
They found us usually.
Yeah,
it was kind of unusual. Like we were traveling a lot through Thailand at the time, and in northern Thailand, there's a place called Chiang Mai. There's a market in Chiang Mai that somehow is the almost the center point for things, whether they're Pakistani or Burmese or actually Thai. You know, and we'd be wandering through these markets just kind of in general, and you'd see these things, you'd be like, wow, that's really great, and let's just grab it and get it over and see what happens. And I think in some of the times we were looking for some of that stuff, but I think it was really forcing ourselves. I think the design firm had gone down a distinctly Americana road with a lot of projects, and we wanted to force ourselves to push our boundaries and try to explore a slightly different cultural point of view and a point of departure.
Yeah, and with the menu as well. I mean, I think a lot of people didn't even know what laksa was, and a couple other, you know, the white bait, which one of my favorite crispy little fish, you know,
appetizer. Fries with eyes.
Yeah. Did you draw inspiration from some of the you know pieces of the restaurant that he brought back, or did you have an idea in mind already of you know what kind of dishes you wanted to have on your menu?
I think the coolest thing that Adam sort of left out with the whole design was that you know they were basically packing up these containers in one in India, one in Chiang Mai, and slow boating them over to Manhattan, and so you know this thing really did come together at the end. There was a game plan, but you couldn't see it evolve as much as public. In public, so much of it is handmade, or you know, they were making the wood right there in the space and doing it with a little metal shop right there in the space.
And you guys stamp all the menus still, and those little
And with Double Crown, it was like, you know, we were kind of working with this really cool idea of it's going to be a melange of all these different markets and spaces. And I think that's what we want to do as well, kind of put together so many of the food markets that we had traveled to And, you know, the food was going to be amazing, but we didn't want to make it super serious, you know, like, and we didn't want to make it. You know, I think so many quote unquote Asian restaurants sort of fall into the same pattern, and we want to avoid those patterns and kind of look at different areas for inspiration, like Singapore and Malaysia, a little bit into Thailand, Vietnam, and even China. You know, I think, you know, that Hong Kong feel to it, that Singapore feel to it, I think works really well.
Yeah, and name some specific dishes. I mean, like from XO sauce that you make in-house to, I don't even know what else you have on the menu right now, but you get these ideas of these very eccentric starts and then make them comforting.
I think sambal is one of our favorite sauces. You know, that's sort of a very general name for chili sauce, but I think the different derivations of sambal are amazing, and the one that we're using a lot is like a three-day cooking process. I think, you know, using the cooking process of cracking a caramel, you know, using caramel to cook your aromats, and how that just drives all the moisture and gives them that kind of slow cooked taste in like 5 minutes. I think, you know, not just using a wok and using noodles and things like that, I think, but
noodles,
but, yeah, but look,
he said noodles.
But I think laksa is a really perfect example of it. It's, you know, again, it's open for interpretation. It's sort of like saying pasta sauce, but I think that it's such a great clean flavor and so unlike anything I've had in New York before. And yet when people have it, it really does transport them right back to Malaysia, to them sitting by the beach.
Believe me, I wish it was a wormhole sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, snap me over there in a second.
Right on.
Do either of you use either your menu or design to influence each other? Like, say, I got a craving for this, so maybe I'll put this up on the wall. Or I got a craving for this, so maybe I'll put this, you know, as an entree, hoping to steer one or another into a new direction.
I think so. I think one thing that's really cool is with the blurring of the lines between the design and the kitchen and the restaurants in general, is that you get someone else's perception of food and of, they get my perception of design, and we might not have the right vocabulary to talk about it, but there is a point that we're trying to get across, and that I think helps each other work outside of, you know, you kind of paint yourself into a corner sometimes and you're going through the same motions. And so it sort of forces you to look at something, a problem or a dish or a table from a different direction. And I think that's great because Everco is so great about that, about, you know, there isn't just one way. And yeah, let's hear your opinion on it. And what does that actually mean? And what can we draw from that? And I think that was great, and that was a great inspiration for teaching. You know, chefs are not necessarily very open people. I think teaching not just myself but everyone in the kitchen that, you know, no, let's have a conversation about this, and maybe that can get us to something better than either of us could have done alone.
Yeah, Everco operates as a semi-reckless oligarchy, and so
do you have that on your business card?
a little bit. But it's the same way that Brad and I operate as brothers, is that, you know, it means that you have the freedom to tell somebody exactly what you think, and that everybody else has the ability to not take it personally, and that means that creatively you're able to try to get past whatever blockades you might have in your head or your own pride in order to kind of get at something that maybe is a little bit better and or deeper and or more meaningful. And I think that happens, you know, sometimes we'll show Brad what we're working on and he's like, that really doesn't look like a good idea. And then we go back to the client and he's like, well, I don't think that really looks like a good idea anymore. So we've redesigned it and they're much happier. And the same thing, I think Brad was mentioning, you know, when there's new dishes coming out, you know, sometimes we'll just get around a table and I'll eat it and be like, wow, that's really amazing. But what if it was like this or like this or like this? And sometimes it's just getting out of your own head a little bit. Sometimes you just get too close to stuff.
Yeah. And aside from food, interior, exterior, I know that you've in the past made uniforms. And even tables, chairs.
We've furniture, lighting, fixtures. You know, we were really inspired by the sort of Bauhausian idea of the Gesamtkunstwerk, where like you could take a project and literally do every single little piece to it. And that's what started us doing the architecture and the interiors and the graphics to projects. And then that bled into doing the furniture and the lighting fixtures. And eventually with the restaurants, you know, the connection to actually the food and the tabletop and the uniforms
The website.
The website. And you know, the goal literally is to be able to, you know, make sure that that concept is pretty thorough throughout. And it's exciting because it means that you get to touch every little last little chunk of it.
Yeah. I mean, are you guys looking to make flatware, tableware, other extensions of the restaurant right now?
We've talked about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely something that's, you know, we just did a line of bar carts that was launched in Asia recently.
And those
were cool.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a beginning of sort of playing around with blurring that line between, you know, serviceware and a furniture piece.
Yeah. I mean, are there future collaborations that you guys are hoping to work on that aren't bar carts, aren't tableware, flatware? Are there, you know, implements that bring things to the table or foods that you want to package and design?
Mm. I think the nice thing is that we have more ideas than we have time. Yeah. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but yeah. I think that, you know, we've done very small runs of certain cool things like our own packaged goods.
Yeah, the food products. That was really a cool experience.
And utensils and tools for the kitchen and things like that. And I think, you know, we do one-offs and there's still, it's still on the list. It's still something that we would love to pursue when we have time.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's sort of larger, right now we've been playing around with doing some sort of odd combination of a small space that's somewhere between a product in itself and an experience. So we're just not sure how it's going to turn out, or when.
Yeah, or even what it is.
Yeah.
Just a quick last question for the both of you. Brad, what would you say a chef should know about a designer, or a designer should know about working with a chef, and conversely with you, Adam?
I think, God, that's a hard one because, again, for us, it's very natural, so it's hard to pick out the exact things. But I think that spending a lot of time with the person to actually pick their brain with ideas and the other way around to make sure that everyone's on the same page, I think that their creative process is going to be very different from yours, and it's no better or worse. You should be open for all those new ideas.
I would say that, you know, just in terms of designers working with chefs, you just got to know that they're volatile.
They carry sharp implements. Yeah.
They're into burning themselves, and they tend to have, you know,
a drinking problem.
I was going to say that. No, I think more than anything else is the fact that there's, you know, the restaurant doesn't exist without the food. So there's a lot of designers that kind of get ahead of themselves relative to how service works, and the best way to really get into it is to be able to sit and work with a chef to understand the ins and outs of why things need to be like they do.
Excellent. Well, I hope that was inspiring advice for all you sibling rivals trying to open up restaurants. I want to thank both of you again for being on the food scene.
Thanks, man.
I hope you guys, you know, got some great little tidbits and gems and are able to work with family better than you did prior. I'd like to thank my sponsor, White Oak Pastures, again, producer Jack Inslee, engineer Nat Wiener. And I hope to, you know, not see you, but have you hearing me next Tuesday at 3 p.m. This is Michael Harlan Turkell. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Yeah.